Welcome to Iconic, where we talk about all things 13th age. I'm your host, JM, and with me as always are Nick and Mark.
Hey.
Hello.
How are you guys doing this week?
Doing really good.
Good. Good gaming good. Going on?
Yes. My guys have discovered the shrine, which I totally stole from you, changed it up. They think it's a chimera factory with all the bones.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't pick up that it was a poltergeist at all. They think it's just magical traps that keep attacking them until they found the dwarf thing. And they didn't intentionally break it, but when it felt warm and thumped in Marcus's hand, he dropped it and it broke. Nice. And then they were all like, oh my God, we killed somebody.
Yeah. Cool. Nick, what about you? Good gaming this week?
Yeah, interesting. A lot of good games. I had in my Numenera game, the party split because half of them were too afraid to go talk to this person. And the half that did go talk to them ended up coming out with a bit of a boon that will greatly benefit them in sessions to come. So half of the party is going to have an easier time with it. And the other half of the party, because they chickened out, could be in trouble.
Awesome. Very cool. Well, we have a great show for you today. We're going to be interviewing Aaron, also known as Wolf Samurai, on Google Plus and Twitter, who has a Patreon where he designs 13th Age material. So yeah, we're just going to get right into the interview with Aaron. Aaron, welcome to Iconic. It's great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, we're just going to get into it. For those of you who are listening and don't know, Aaron has a Patreon that produces 13th Age content, as well as you were a contributor on Bestiary 2. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I've also worked on a number of other projects. I've done some of the 13th Age organized play adventures, and I also worked on the Nocturne setting that came out from Savage Mojo that was originally a failed Kickstarter, but eventually we got it released.
Yeah, you guys got it across the finish line. And you do the Roll20 updates or the Roll20 content for the 13th Age adventures, is that right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I'm the project manager for the adventures that we've put on Roll20. At this point, there's three of them. I'm not sure where we stand on the next ones, but hopefully there will be many more of those.
Any chance that you guys are working on converting Eyes of the Stone Thief?
That's
that'd be a lot of work.
I would really love to do that, but man, that's a big one. Not least because since Eyes of the Stone Thief is very configurable, mm-hmm, to whatever your campaign happens to be, making it on Roll20 would be a bit of a challenge. It's not to say that I wouldn't like to give it a go, especially since I love the isometric maps in
they were
Eyes of the Stone Thief. They're so nice. I would absolutely love to do that, but it would be a considerable undertaking just from the number of monsters that we'd have to make art for.
Yeah,
to put on Roll20.
Hey, Aaron, this is Mark. How did you get into RPGs?
Well, unlike a lot of people, I didn't start off with D&D. A lot of people I know, they started with BD&D or second edition or, mm-hmm, something like that. I actually started with Shadowrun. And I started with it because I played Shadowrun on the Super Nintendo in like 92 or 93 or something like that. And I was so blown away with that game, and it still remains to this day one of my favorite video games, that I went and did searching out more stuff. And I happened to notice that on some of the shelves at my local bookstore, they had Shadowrun stuff. And it first started with novels. And then from there, I learned that it was a tabletop game, and it all went from there. So that was about the start of second edition Shadowrun, I think.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And it's been quite a while. And it's been ever since then. Shadowrun is still, some people get grognardy about D&D. I get grognardy about Shadowrun just because that's what I started off with.
Mark and I are shaking our
heads. Shaking my head because that was when I started in RPGs, but I was in the Army station out in the Seattle area, met some guys looking for a D&D group. They didn't play D&D. They played these other games. One of them happened to be Shadowrun, got into second edition, and I've been hooked ever since.
Yeah, I've got every core rule book for every edition of Shadowrun, except for first edition. I haven't gotten that one yet, but every other one, yeah, I've got it. Even when I'm not playing it, I like to kind of keep up with it, you know?
Yeah.
That's just the way
I still buy missions and download them just for future possibilities.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I just got Shadowrun Anarchy, the alternative rule set, this past week, and I've been reading through that. So it's,
Not to get off track, how do you like that?
It's interesting. It feels like it's definitely more rules light than the core Shadowrun experience. It's definitely stripped down. And it feels like somebody who read through Fate kind of wanted to integrate at least some of the ideas and concepts behind Fate into it. And it's got a nice vibe to it. I think it would be fun to play with people who aren't necessarily into the same level of crunch of the core Shadowrun rules. And it definitely, I think, emphasizes the storytelling element of tabletop a lot more. It's just a more integral part of the rule set, I think.
Right.
It's really cool.
If they don't like crunch, they are not allowed at my table.
Well, I'll have to look into that. I haven't had any experience with Shadowrun before, but it sounds intriguing.
We've done you a disservice now.
I know. One of these days.
But we're here to talk about 13th Age.
That's right. So Aaron, how did you make the transition from, you know, just playing in games and maybe running some games to actually creating content and then getting it out there on the market?
It's kind of interesting, my entry into the 13th Age, quote unquote, professional market. I started off just being a regular player, GM, mostly GM. And I did a lot of demo games and I was running my own campaign. A lot of people really liked the demo games that I was doing. And they were mentioning to Wade Rocket and some of the other people that work for Pelgrane or Fire Opal that, you know, I was doing a really good job and they bought the game because of me. And eventually that turned around and I talked to Wade and everybody and Jay from Fire Opal, and they're like, yeah, we want you on board. We want you to do online gaming stuff. We want you to help with that. Initially, that was all they really intended for me to do was, you know, we're going to have you run online games. We're going to help you get more of our stuff online onto like Roll20 and the like. And not too long after I joined the crew, they were starting up the third organized play adventure from the first season of organized play. And they needed some more writers. And I'm like, I'm willing to do some writing for this if you're willing to have me. And so I wrote a couple of the sections for, I believe it was Shadowport Shuffle.
Okay.
And I had a really good time, and everybody seemed to like what I did. And then I worked on some more organized play adventures. And about that time, I decided that I really wanted to do more than just work on other people's stuff. I wanted to work on my own projects, create my own stuff. But finding the time for that was sometimes kind of difficult. And that's why I launched the Patreon. This was about August of 2014, just as to help have a little more incentive to be able to justify it to myself a little bit more. Mm-hmm. So that's been going on for quite a while. And as that's gone on, I've been able to do some more major projects like Nocturne or like Bestiary 2. And it's been a really good creative outlet because I can basically do whatever I want on there. I can, if I get an interesting idea for 13th Age, I can work it from there. And I don't feel like I'm beholden to anybody else except for my patrons in terms of what I'm doing. It's not like I have to make something that's marketable or that is within a certain word count because I'm working entirely within PDF. But that being said, it is nice to work with other people. I really like doing collaborative projects. So that's stuff like Nocturne and Bestiary 2 was a lot of fun for me as well.
That's awesome.
So let's take a quick step back. What drew you initially to 13th Age as a game?
Well, what had happened was about the time 13th Age was announced or a little bit into development, I think it was in this case, was about the time that Wizards of the Coast was noticeably winding down D&D 4E. Mm-hmm. And I'd been a really big 4E player. I had and still do have almost all the fourth edition books. I really enjoyed playing it. And as they were winding it down, I'm like, I kind of want another game to play since this is going to be lacking material. And at that point, they were also changing the way that like D&D Insider worked. Mm-hmm. So having access to the character builder was more sporadic. So that was another consideration. I wanted a game that I didn't feel like I needed an external program to make a character for. And then I saw that Rob and Jonathan were working on this game and that it seemed to have elements of both third and fourth edition. And I decided to get in on it. I pre-ordered around Escalation Edition 2. and read through it over the next week, and I was immediately hooked. I loved a lot of the concepts, even though not everything was very much in flux at that point. What I could see there was tremendously exciting for just to see the different approaches to the D&D style game. Mm-hmm. And that's what really hooked me. I didn't get to play it for a while, but I did start my first game around Escalation Edition 5 before the wizard was completely intact. And by that point I was like, yeah, if I want to play a fantasy style game, this is what I want to reach to first.
Well, as a fellow fourth edition lover, I appreciate that's how you came to 13th Age, or that's what you came out of. I feel like we are few and far between those of us who actually like ran and enjoyed fourth edition.
Boo.
Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately. But, I definitely feel like this was what fourth edition, I don't know if it maybe what fourth edition should be, but I think this was definitely 13th Age was definitely the evolution of yes. some of the things that were done in fourth edition. And that's again, part of why I really liked it. I was not so far afield from what I was already looking for, and had already been playing with fourth edition.
Yeah, I totally agree.
So if this is an evolved fourth edition, what's your favorite mechanic in 13th Age?
My favorite mechanic is backgrounds, far and away. I love backgrounds because they are such an elegant solution to a problem that I've had with not just D&D, but a lot of games with a skill list. It is definitely one of those things that where I, in both 3rd edition and 4th edition and many other games, it's like, I want to take a skill because it fits my character background. It fits the mm-hmm. the fluff that I've generated for this character. Like, you know, say I wanted to be a blacksmith my character used to be a blacksmith. Sure, in a lot of cases, I could take that skill, but that's often taking away from a very limited resource pool, like skill points, that I could be using towards something that is more immediately relevant. And I really hated having to sacrifice the practical elements of my character for the background elements. And so backgrounds, as in 13th Age, are such an elegant solution to that I, to this day, they are my favorite thing about it. And I love the way they work. I love explaining them to people, like when I'm doing demos, and I get really invested in that because they are so well designed in that respect to because they keep evolving. It's like, all right, I've got a city guard background. Well, okay, you've got some base assumptions from that, but as you use it, as you branch out and describe events where you had used it in the past, thus justifying your current use, you're evolving your character. You're continuing to grow the history of that character, and that is one of my favorite things about it, is that it's a constantly evolving thing. It's not just a static skill where you go, all right, well, I know how to sneak, or, you know, I'm good at horse riding. It's a constantly changing thing as you describe the things you do with it.
Right. And and I like how it as you're talking about evolving, it helps define the character's past in context of their current game.
And not just the character. I like the way it also adds to the world.
Yeah.
If you say, well, all guards know how to climb ropes, suddenly that's what the guards...
Oh yeah,
in this city. No, you can add it. Okay, now that's now canon.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And then you ask yourself, well, why do all guards climb ropes? Well, just for whatever reason to in this thieves. City, mm-hmm. All of the doors are 10 feet off the ground.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's absolutely a defining element, and mm-hmm. that's something that about 13th Age in general is that it lets the players define that, and backgrounds are definitely a part of that as well. I always work whether I'm doing a demo or whether I'm playing an actual campaign, I always work with characters to kind of bring out more from their backgrounds, because it's easy to do something like, all right, city guard. It's not a bad background. It's certainly fine, but I always encourage players to be a little more specific, mm-hmm. Because it more immediately defines their character and the world. So if you say, you know, I was part of the Night Watch in Shadowport, all of a sudden you've determined two things, that there is a Night Watch in Shadowport and that you are part of it. And immediately it brings to mind a number of different things that saying I was a night guardsman in Glitterhagen might not. So I always encourage just a little more specificity with backgrounds for that very reason, because you're helping define a number of things more clearly. And it's a lot more fun, I think, if there's a little more specific nature to the backgrounds than just something a little more generic. I mean, you could have, you know, fighter or gladiator as a background, but if you have something a little more defined, it's more interesting for everybody at the table, because, you know, every time you go to roll that skill, it's a little more fun to hear somebody saying, you know, that they were a former mercenary as opposed to a fighter, mm-hmm. you know? So that's one of the reasons that I like to get a little more specific. Some people don't, and that's perfectly fine as well. As long as it's not so generic that it's applicable to everything.
Right.
I don't really mind if people want to make it a little more
players don't
general.
Do that.
Yeah.
Well, it's nice that it's capped at five.
Yeah. So, well, let's take a step back. Let's talk about your Patreon. Like, what are you working on? How do you have it set up? What if someone knows nothing about it?
Well, people are not familiar with Patreon at all, it is a service to allow micropayments to creators to allow them to make things. And you can have it set up whether it's a per project or per month basis. Mine is set up on a per month basis. And by and large, I create one thing, possibly two a month, depending on my schedule and the complexity of the particular project. I've been doing this since August of 2014. So there's a lot of backlog in terms of the things I've done. I've done everything from classes to new races to adventures and NPCs, monsters, the whole nine yards. Basically, almost anything you can think of a role-playing game needing, I've done at least once or twice. And recently I've been working on a whole new setting that's called Shattered Horizons. I've been slowly working on it as a part of the Patreon. I haven't been working on it too much outside of the Patreon just yet, though I do want to get to that point sooner rather than later. And Shattered Horizons is a setting that's inspired by like the 16-bit video game RPGs like Chrono Trigger and Final Fantasy VI and so on and so forth. And it's post-apocalypse. There's been a couple of devastating things that have shaken up or if not outright destroyed civilization, including the deaths of the gods and eventually forced survivors to fly floating islands in the sky. And that's about a few hundred years after the last apocalypse is where the setting, when the setting takes place.
I think I sent you an email. Like, I think we chatted a little bit about it. I really enjoyed the first Shattered Horizon adventure, and it really does speak to like Chrono Trigger or Final Fantasy III. That's the vibe I got out of it.
The first adventure also includes a setting primer, and mm-hmm. that's been released free to the public. It's I believe I have it. I don't know if I've put it on 13thAge.org. If I haven't, I should really do that. But it's definitely available on my Patreon, if nowhere else. And it involves going down to what are currently called Scourge Beasts, which are basically like Godzilla or Koro Behemoth-sized monsters that were part of the last apocalypse. They showed up and eventually destroyed the ground civilizations, forcing them to flee. But they weren't killed, and they kind of went dormant. But through experimentation and exploration, people found out that you could actually go into these dormant beasts and gather certain important resources from them. Your adventurers in this particular adventure are going to a camp where they were doing this resource collection that has gone silent, and you have to find out what's gone on and either rescue everybody or at least collect the resources that they were last gathering. And I tried to make it representative of a lot of the different things that Shattered Horizons does, the Scourge Beasts, the magical technology like airships and guns that use crystals to fire bolts of magical energy and that sort of thing. And that was a lot of fun to work on. And it's the reaction that I've gotten from it has been very positive, which is encouraging for working on the setting going into the future. Because, I mean, when you start working on something like that, you're not always sure what people are going to react and how they're going to react and what they're going to think about it. And everybody really enjoyed it. And everybody has since been wanting to see more of Shattered Horizon stuff, which is very encouraging and heartening from my side. It's always easier as a creator to work on stuff if you know that people are out there and they're going to enjoy it.
So when you're working on all of that, you know, whether it be the classes or NPCs or monsters, adventures, all that, where do you find your inspiration for that? Is it the stuff that your patrons are like submitting to you? Or is this, I know that as investing in you as a creator, it's just basically empowering you to keep making great stuff. But, you know, what inspires you?
I mean, I do take suggestions from patrons. I really like working from patron suggestions, actually, because in a lot of respects, they are things that I would have never thought of myself. And it's interesting for me to take somebody else's idea and try to make it a reality through my own interpretive lens. Mm-hmm. I think that's a lot of fun. That's really interesting. It's a more creative challenge, but in a good way. It keeps me on my toes and forces me to think outside the box a little bit more. And that's always important as a creator to constantly challenge yourself to do new and different things. When I'm working on stuff from my own perspective, I pull from a lot of the media that I consume, whether it be movies or books. I pull a lot from video games as well, which I think is a bit unusual in the tabletop RPG world, because there is overlap certainly between tabletop gamers and video gamers, but I don't think quite as many designers start with video games as an inspiration. I definitely do. I've done projects that involve making weapons inspired by Legend of Zelda. I have a project where I want to make monsters inspired by Nintendo games,
like
Metroid or even Super Mario Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And I like pulling from video games because there's a lot of creative and interesting work there. And a lot of them can be made to be very, very cool kind of things when brought back into the tabletop environment, doing things that the video game variation never really could. And I like doing that. It's fun. And even when I'm not making something that's a direct conversion, just seeing what I respond to in media can give me an idea for something that I want to do with tabletop. If I'm seeing a lot of stuff, if I'm watching a lot of horror or reading a lot of horror media, then I get the feeling I want to explore horror as a part of fantasy tabletop, and I frequently do. It's sometimes a little too much, honestly. I like genre mixing, and the one I tend to go back to when I can't think of anything is horror. And sometimes I want to apologize for that, but at the same time, I really love doing horror as a part of fantasy. So mm-hmm. I can't apologize too much because it is something I really enjoy. But the media I consume tends to be the springboard for a lot of what I do. Sometimes it's a direct conversion, as mentioned, but sometimes it's just this monster looks cool. What is this monster? How can I make it a tabletop thing? What is the history? Can I make a history for this that is interesting? And sometimes that's all it needs. Sometimes it's just, this looks cool. Let's go with it. Let's see what I can do with this.
Well, and if it's the well you keep going back to and finding inspiration, then I don't think there's a need to apologize for that necessarily. Like, I mean,
no,
I totally get it.
It's just that sometimes I think, especially when I'm GMing games, I think players are like, oh, look, it's another undead or, you know, a cult devoted to some brain smashing eldritch entity or something like that. I try not to repeat myself too much, but there are some tropes that are well worn mm-hmm. with me for sure. And to keep myself from becoming like a one note, that I have to keep myself aware that I don't necessarily want to do that all the time. I want to keep branching out. I want to keep doing things. I can come back to horror. That's fine. But I can't just keep doing horror. It's a way of keeping myself from going back to the same well too many times.
That makes perfect sense. So some of your monster designs made it into Bestiary 2. You worked on Bestiary 2. What was your favorite piece that you contributed to that product?
It's a hard one because I really enjoyed... I worked on three monsters predominantly for Bestiary 2. I did the Battle Shades, I did Darrow, mm-hmm. and I did the Elemental Beasts. And all of them had a different vibe and feel to them. But I think, honestly, the one that was the most fun for me was the Darrow. In this case, because it wasn't something that I was making up from scratch. It was putting a new spin, an interpretive spin on an established, long-established fantasy D&D monster. And Darrow had, to me, always been a little forgettable. They weren't something that I that came to mind when I thought of D&D monsters very much. I wanted to kick things up to 11 with them. I wanted to make them something that people would look at and remember when they encountered them in their game, or even when they're just reading the material and seeing the amazing art that goes with it. They were a lot of fun because I did dip into kind of what I really like to do, which is the horror, the things that are just terrible to consider, and make the Darrow just completely unhinged psychic psychopaths. And they're disturbing. I wanted to make them disturbing and wrong, and I think I did a pretty good job of that. They are just unhinged.
As they should be.
Yeah. They're depending on how my 13th age game goes on Saturday, they may find themselves on the paths towards a Darrow encampment. So
yeah, one of the most fun with the Darrow was coming up with the potential origins, which is something I really like about D&D in general, is that a lot of things are very mutable and you get to decide for your own campaign how they work. But coming up with the potential origins for them was very interesting, because it allowed me to suggest rather than dictate history for the Dragon Empire. And that's something that I find really cool. One fun thing, one of the things that there are a number of plot hooks with all of the, well, not all of them, but with many of the monsters in there. There was a plot hook that ended up getting cut because it was maybe a little too far out for Darrow. But the plot hook that I came up with that I still really love was that there were rumors that there is a pirate ship in the inner sea. Much to everybody's confusion and consternation, they appear to be Darrow pirates. and I think it might have been a little too far out there for Rob and what he wanted from Darrow, but I still love the idea of Darrow pirates. It's just, write that down, Dan. So entertaining.
All right, I'll write that down for our
Darrow pirates.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic.
So as the white dragon is our mascot, who is the white?
The white, to me, the most fun origin for the white that I came up with was that the white was a creation of the Wizard King. The magic that made him kind of retroactively created a history for the white dragons in general. There was never any kind of elder dragon equivalent for the whites, the white dragons, and that the Wizard King decided to make one so he would have some hold over the white dragons, and eventually the white rebelled, and that's why he was forced to destroy him.
I dig it.
That was the most fun that I had coming up with the white, because it is kind of difficult to come up with a history for basically a posthumous character like that.
Why we ask everybody, just kind of gathering the data. Kind of here at the end of the interview, what's next for you with 13th Age? What's next for the Patreon?
Well, the Patreon's going to continue with Shattered Horizons. I also like to do other more general stuff. I've got a general adventure that I'd really like to do. It's sticking in my head, and I need to write it to get it out. I've also pitched a few things to Rob and Fire Opal and Pelgrane in general that I'm hoping will eventually get on the publishing schedule. Right now things are not quite settled, so I don't know if where that's gone, but I'm hoping, fingers crossed, that there will be some more stuff with my name on it coming out in the next year or two. I don't want to talk about it too much just in case it doesn't get picked up, and you know, don't want people to go, all right, where is this coming out?
Right, it's, totally get that.
Maybe it's not, but I really hope some of them do.
Well, Aaron, I mean, that's kind of what we had for the interview. Guys, do you have any other final questions? Aaron, do you have any final comments?
No, I really don't. I appreciate you guys for having me on. It's been a lot of fun. I love talking 13th Age, and you guys do a really great job with the podcast. I know a lot of people were very excited to see you guys coming back for a second season.
Oh, shucks.
And I can definitely understand why.
Well, we appreciate that. If you're all right with it, we may have you on again just to talk 13th Age.
Yeah, I'd absolutely love that. I enjoy doing it, especially if you've got a specific topic that you'd like to go over. I'd have a lot of fun with that.
Awesome.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you very much. Hope you guys have a good day.
All right, you too. Well, that was our interview with Aaron, Wolf Samurai again. We'll put a link to his work and his where you can find him online in the show notes. I just have to say, as one of his patrons, I've been a patron for a couple of months now, and well worth it. The content that you get and the content that you have access to immediately, go check him out.
I will.
Sounds good.
And thank you to Pelgrim Press and Petrie's Family Games for being sponsors of the show. Well, you've been listening to the Iconic Podcast.
If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, you can contact us at iconicpodcast@gmail.com or call and leave a voicemail at 720-924-1706.
And be sure to check out iconicpodcast.com for news, updates, and new episodes.
Thanks for listening.